Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. To Cousins on Crime in our new
studio.
Hey, look, we may not have carpet, but
it's a good thing that we're not on camera at the moment.
I forgot to take a picture. I've got to take a picture. Yeah, so we figured we would just, you know, let's go ahead and move in.
Yeah.
I keep telling my dad I'm gonna be moving in soon. They put all the doors in, they're framing out the windows. I'm like, to me, that says,
yeah, hello,
you can move in now.
Welcome.
It says welcome. I don't want to chit chat too much because okay. I'm just dying to tell you this story.
I'm dying to hear it because I think I know what you're going to tell me.
You know, guys, if you notice the name in the title of this episode and you have your finger on the pulse of true crime,
mm-hmm.
then you know what this is all about, okay? You may know what some of it's about. If you have no idea, the crimes I'm going to tell you about today are devastating because most of them might have gone unsolved if it hadn't been for Dina. Sadly, the murderer killed himself before he could ever face justice. In fact, most of his crimes weren't linked to him until after he was long gone. Mm. So there was breaking news this weekend that the killer in the yogurt shop murders had been identified.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is huge.
Yeah.
We've never covered the yogurt shop murders. I think for me, it's been covered on every podcast, and there's been like a recent documentary that's come out.
Yeah, and we had a friend who's also a listener. She's like, they solved this.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, just wait. Candace is going to tell us all about it.
So I will be discussing, if you want a deep dive on just take your pick. There's like I said, the documentary, there's a lot of podcasts that has covered it. And it's widely covered, not just because it's a shocking crime, but because it went unsolved for decades.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we've been hearing a lot of these crimes that are going decades long.
Right, right. So Friday evening when I saw this breakthrough in the yogurt shop murders case, I was stunned when I read the suspect's name, Robert Eugene Brashears. Now, I had begun research on this serial killer last year, and I always struggle with serial. You know, I'm kind of like partial to serial killers just because I'm so curious about their minds, but I always struggle to tell the story because I want to make sure that the victims don't get just grouped together.
Right.
And so I had put that aside, I probably had maybe two or three pages of notes on this guy. I just needed some time to think before covering him. Mm-hmm. And then Friday happened and I text Lena and I was like, okay,
now's the time.
So I gently and calmly put aside the case I was working on and dove headfirst into my Word document that had all my notes.
Love it.
And I got to work and I was like, can I pull this off in a weekend? Because
I feel like that's your best cases,
right?
Was when you're just like, I gotta do this right now.
I was obsessed. And Daniel was like, what? And I was like, they solved the yogurt shop murders. And he's like, what? And I'm like, this is huge. Mm-hmm. It's massive. And so this was interesting because if I hadn't been so fired up, I would have really struggled to write this episode because I almost need to tell this story in two timelines.
Okay.
His timeline, Robert Eugene Brashears.
Okay.
Why do we always say their middle name like they're a scholar. It makes them sound like they're smart right. or something. Let's just call him Rob, Robert. So like his timeline and then his victims, because there are so many intersections and deviations between these two timelines. But I want to tell the victim's story. So I'm going to go with their stories, and he will just serve as like connective tissue really
sure.
throughout the episode. Anyway, let's get started. So November 11th, 1985, 25-year-old Michelle Wilkerson was walking near her home in Fort Pierce, Florida. Also saw Port St. Lucie.
Oh.
I think they're
next to each other.
Like Fort Pierce is the county or something. Didn't look it up. Because anyway, I was fired up, guys. Okay, I'm not like doing geography.
You had other things to look for.
Right. This guy pulls up next to her and offered her a ride. Now, Michelle accepted. It was 1985, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was different times.
It was nothing to just hitchhike.
Yeah. And so she goes for a ride with this guy, presumably to go to a bar to drink.
Okay.
Some reports said they actually did go to a bar and that's where they met. And then some said they didn't even make it to the bar before the man driving revealed his true intentions. He didn't just want to go for a ride. He wanted sex.
Mm.
And now's probably a good time to give a trigger warning, because every trigger warning is probably needed in this episode.
Okay.
There's rape of children. There is murder. You name it.
Mm.
So Michelle rejected him. She was not looking for that. She just was looking for a good time and tried to get out of his truck. And that made him really mad.
Oh, I'm
he was
sure.
not inclined to being rejected. So he shot her twice in the head.
Ugh.
I saw one report said he shot her in the head and in the neck. It almost doesn't matter which is true, because miraculously, Michelle survived.
Oh, really?
Spoiler, she survives. But when she hightailed it out of that truck, she's bleeding from the neck, head,
wherever.
She runs her buns off, and she found a road culvert to hide in.
Oh, wow.
This is literally a horror movie.
Yeah.
So she stays there for a minute and waits till like it's quiet. She's crawling through this road culvert until she gets out the other side, and then she takes off through a field. And then she sees this house that was like, it was used as an office building. So nobody was there.
Oh.
So she finds this phone. I don't know if it was a payphone or if she actually went inside. Mm. The reports are unclear. Anyway, she called the police and waited for them to arrive. The police said she was so amazing that she got in a truck that was like parked outside and turned the lights on so they could see her.
Wow.
Yeah.
She knew exactly what to do. Even being shot and wow.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So by the time police got there, it was about 3 a.m. and she was clinging to life.
Ugh.
Michelle was rushed to Lawnwood Regional Medical Center, where she was stabilized. And then she was able to describe her attacker. They radioed the description to the field deputy, Angela Darling. Isn't that, isn't that just precious?
She was darling.
Like, wait a minute. That guy sounds familiar.
Oh.
Like, I know that truck and I know that guy, because this guy had gotten stuck in the sand at Frederick Douglass Beach that night. He was there tossing his gun into the sea.
Okay.
Yeah. A violent criminal and a litter bug. Charming. So Robert Bashirs was identified as Michelle's attacker, leading to his conviction on attempted first-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, aggravated battery, and use of a firearm in the commission of a felony. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison. 12 years.
Whopping years.
I'm not sure how you're feeling right now, listener. Lena, I don't know how you're feeling. Maybe you're thinking that's not enough. Or maybe you're thinking, you know, that's a pretty good sentence considering this is his first recorded violent crime. Surely this will set things right, right?
I mean, no. I would say it's not long enough.
Take a deep breath.
Okay.
Because I'm about to tell you how many of those 12 years he served.
Oh, don't do it.
In the words of Mr. Owl, 1, 2, 3. 3.
No. No.
And in the words of Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, big mistake. Huge.
Yeah, I'd say.
This early release would destroy countless lives. And I do mean countless, because I'm confident that the victims I'm about to tell you about are the ones that we know of. Mm-hmm. I guarantee there are more.
Oh, that makes me so sick.
Greenville, South Carolina, April 4th, 1990. 28-year-old Genevieve Zitricki. Her employer was a bit concerned because she hadn't come into work in a couple days, and that just was not her style. He contacted the apartment complex she lived in because she wasn't answering her phone. And they're like, you know what? Can you just go check on Jenny? That's what they called her. And the maintenance man knocked. No answer. So he lets himself in and certainly didn't expect to find a crime scene.
Oh, no.
He found Jenny's body in a bathtub with running water. And it was clear that she had been deceased a while.
Oh, wow.
The medical examiner determined she had been brutally beaten and raped and strangled to death.
So I guess it was flooding, because since the water was running, I mean, yeah, I guess that's a moot point, but.
I mean, that's a good point. I'm not sure if she just had really great drains and it was just going for 2 days.
Okay.
It's possible there was a mess involved. At the scene, police found a bloody mess in her room, which suggested that Jenny was asleep in her bed when her attacker began beating her where she lay. There was pooling of blood on the floor where he had drug Jenny's unconscious body down to the floor where he raped her. He put Jenny's body in the bathtub, and though she was likely on death's door, he strangled her. For good measure.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, she was unresponsive. And he was like, I better go ahead and just make sure. He also placed some of her things that he had rifled through, like her purse, keys. He placed those in the sink and ran water all over it. Just so he's thinking, I'm going to run water on her body, on all this stuff. My prints won't be found. Right. My DNA won't be found. Well, we know. Mm-hmm. We know that he didn't succeed in that. There was one more thing, though, of note at the scene. There was a message scrawled across her bedroom mirror in Sharpie, which said, "Don't f*** with my family."
What?
I think in the beginning, this clue suggested to authorities that this killing may have been personal. And that whoever did this may be retaliating or trying to send a message aimed at Jenny or maybe someone that she knew. But there was nothing in Jenny's life to indicate that anyone would have wanted her dead.
So it's just throwing authorities off.
Right. As the years went on, with no leads, no tips, this message on the mirror kind of was a little more confusing, because they're like, they just chalked it up to a diversion tactic. So poor Jenny, her case just sat and sat, and it would sit for years just waiting to be solved.
So frustrating.
The following year, December 6th, 1991, police responded to a yogurt shop in Austin, Texas that was engulfed in raging flames. Responders had been alerted that there were people inside, but they had no clue. They had no clue the horror that awaited them. And this would become one of the most tragic cold cases in the city of Austin. Eliza Thomas, 17, Amy Ayers, 13, and sisters Jennifer and Sarah Harbison, 17 and 15, respectively. I saw one report that said Sarah was 13. Tomato, tomato. They were found bound, gagged, and murdered inside before being set on fire. Their autopsies determined they had all been shot in the head, and though it was difficult to tell, at least one of them had been raped.
Oh, wow.
Authorities couldn't believe that someone would do this to children.
Yeah.
Four innocent children. And we always talk about like being in a group and like how it's safest in a group. And these girls, the two younger girls met the two older girls there early so that they could all go home together.
Okay.
And be safe.
Be safe. Yeah.
So Eliza and Jennifer worked at the Froyo place. I can't believe it's not yogurt. And they were closing that night. Like I said, Sarah, Jennifer's little sister, and her friend Amy decided to head up to the yogurt shop so they could, you know, hang out while the older girls were doing their closing routines. And maybe they would lend a hand. Who knows? Maybe they would help stuff napkins. I don't know. Anyway, afterwards, they would all go home together. And that's why they were all there together after closing. A task force was shortly formed after this tragedy, solely devoted to finding out who did this and why. At one point in the investigation, four guys were arrested for the crime. Two of them were actually convicted of the crime, but their convictions were later overturned because the evidence just wasn't there. I mean, the only thing detectives had on these guys was the fact that they incriminated themselves. And we know how that goes.
Right.
That just wasn't enough. So despite the killer torching the yogurt establishment in hopes of destroying all traces of evidence, sounds like his other crimes, and hoping that nobody knows he'd ever been there, he just wasn't clever enough because a bullet casing with his DNA fell down into a drain in the back room. So despite extensive fire and water damage, a single male profile was found on that bullet, which also matched the DNA found on the sexual assault victim.
Okay. I just want to say, I think it's pretty impressive that they looked into the drain.
Right.
I mean, come on.
I mean.
Anyway, carry on.
I can't. And we've talked about fires before and how, like, how do you even know what's what?
Right.
And this is graphic, but two of the girls were like melted to each other because one was laying on top of the other. And I just can't imagine the task of trying to, where do you start? Like, where do you even start? Can I stand on anything? Like, I'm scared to even stand in this location. So I just admire those firefighters who can go in there and those fire investigators who know what to look for.
Yeah.
And they're like we see everything as just black and they're like, oh, okay, I can see the discrepancies and I can see the, so it's just so cool to me. So they did have evidence in that case. They just didn't have anyone to match it to.
Right.
So here's the big news. Just days ago, September 26th, 2025, news broke that dirty, nasty, vile DNA belonged to Robert Eugene Brashears. February 18th, 1992, Robert was arrested for possession of a stolen vehicle and stolen gun. Guys, this was months after he had murdered these four girls.
Where was he arrested at?
Tennessee.
Ah.
I'm pretty sure it's Tennessee because
he was just road tripping.
He was everywhere.
Yeah.
He was all over the place. And I think it's Tennessee because in the vehicle that was stolen, he had a fake police jacket, a police scanner, lock picking tools, and he also had a fake Tennessee ID.
So devious.
I know. So they're like, ew. They're like, oh, you've stolen this truck and you've got a weapon and ew, you're nasty. You're real gross. Look at all your paraphernalia in here. So surprisingly, or maybe I'm not at all surprised anymore, his possessions charges landed him in even hotter water than the Michelle Wilkerson attack did. He served almost 5 years for the stolen goods.
What?
Now, possibly because he had been convicted of attempted murder before, and now he was getting a little bit heavier of a sentence. Or maybe they didn't connect the two. Who knows? Ugh. They certainly didn't know that they had the yogurt shop murder
right.
in prison already. And they continued to investigate. I bet Robert Brashears was sitting there in prison, eating his slop, reading the newspaper, thinking, no way. Like when these other kids were getting convicted of it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because there were two guys that were sitting in the yogurt shop, like as the girls were closing. The authorities were so hung up on these two guys because they had like a bag of coins and like it was really strange. They didn't order anything. Why were they sitting there? And it was just like they really fixated. So he's probably sitting in there just laughing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, y'all are way off.
Yeah.
So when he was released in February 1997, he certainly wasn't a changed man. That's for sure. He was poised and ready to get back to work.
He had probably been scheming all kinds of...
You know, he was fantasizing about what he was going to do when he got out.
I want to know, who are the people letting this man out? Okay.
They ought to be lined up with the rest of them.
Yeah.
Because you know, they aren't the only ones out there.
I know it.
So just days after his release... March 11th, he broke into a home in Memphis, Tennessee, and raped a 14-year-old girl who was at home with her friends. There is not much known about this crime because she was a child. A lot of that information is under lock and key and safeguarded, as it should be.
Right.
I don't know the dynamics of how he gets in and rapes her when all her friends are there. I don't know. But he's disgusting. He's brazen, and he can't help himself. A couple weeks later, March 28th, 1998, in Portageville, Missouri, all over the place, Stephen Shearer and his dad, Tony, arrived home to find a horrifying sight. Stephen was 14 years old, and as he entered the living room, first, he saw his mother, Sherry, and his sister, Megan, shot dead. He screamed for his dad, who was just coming around the corner, and joined his son in this absolute nightmare that was their home. Sherry was on the floor, bound and shot multiple times in the head. And this is tough. 12-year-old Megan was laid over an ottoman, shot, and clearly had been raped.
Oh my gosh.
The guy is disgusting. He's filthy.
Yeah.
So after Tony's desperate 911 call, police arrived and began piecing together this puzzle. The home wasn't disturbed, really, to the extent that there had been a murder in the living room, but it wasn't, you know, there wasn't things turned over. The women didn't have any real defensive wounds to speak of, like noticeable. And as I mentioned earlier, they were bound. And it's highly likely that Sherry complied because of their lack of defensive wounds. And especially if he was threatening to do something to her daughter, she probably would have done anything.
Right.
But once he started raping her daughter, she wasn't going to sit by for that. So that's...
Okay.
I would imagine you just have to shoot me right in the face.
Yeah, really.
No way.
No.
I pray to God she didn't see any of that. Now, police collected all the evidence they could think of at the scene, the bindings that the ladies were tied up in, fingerprints, blood. They swabbed Megan's body, and DNA was in its early days, so they didn't know what, if anything, they were collecting that was usable, but they were just trying to get whatever they could.
Good on them.
To generate, you know, even a partial DNA profile. Well, they found a disgusting... hair on Megan's body, and there was a bite mark on her bum.
Oh, no.
So they swabbed that area, and that's where they got a full DNA profile later.
I mean, this guy, he's just evil.
Disgusting.
It's pure evil.
This mother and daughter spent their last moments in absolute terror. Megan was such a happy kid, by all accounts. She loved the simple things that made life good. And something really good about her life was her mom.
Aww.
I mean, Sherry, she loved and doted on her kids. She loved being a mom. Their deaths were a tremendous loss to everyone who knew them. And again, it would sit cold for years and years. The very same day that Sherry and Megan were murdered, and according to Missouri State Highway Patrol, it was only 2 hours later, there was another attack across the Mississippi in Dyersburg, Tennessee.
What in the world?
I know. A 25-year-old woman had just got home with her kids and was outside unloading groceries from her car when this guy comes up to her and asked her for this neighbor's house. He gives this name and she's like, well, I don't know this person. And she's like, well, let me go call my brother. He knows everybody around here. And she was kind of half joking. But as she turned to walk in the house, like, she's like, something's not right about this. She just felt like, you know, he's too confident. This is too weird. He was too sure of himself pulling over and asking me for who this neighbor was. And so she goes back outside and he's coming up fast with a gun. Now, she fought him for the gun.
Oh.
And she was shot in the arm, but he managed to escape.
So he just ran off.
And the woman survived and she was able to give a description of Robert to the police. And a sketch was drafted and circulated, just like the sketch from the 14-year-old. Just like the sketch from the Michelle Wilkerson crime. And I'm going to post these sketches because they're ridiculous.
So were they thinking, hey, this is the same guy? Or they weren't? Because they were in different places.
They were all in different places.
Yeah, I'd like to see those.
Yeah, they're funny. They all look different and they all look nothing like him.
Oh.
So, anywho, the projectile that was recovered from this woman's arm was later determined to have been fired from the same gun that killed Sherry and Megan Shearer. So now they have these two crimes on the same day connected.
Right.
So pretty early on, they have these cases linked. And it wasn't until 2006, 8 years later, that there was a huge break. The DNA profile generated in the Shearer case was matched to a profile collected from a murder down in Greenville, South Carolina. Jenny Zetricki. Now, the police in Tennessee and Missouri were like, what the heck? South Carolina now? They're like, I mean, we're kind of located next to each other, but like South Carolina, this guy's all over the place.
Yeah.
And so they realized they were dealing with someone on another level.
Yeah.
Who was going to be hopping around. And they realized we should be looking at other cases.
Everywhere.
Exactly. If they didn't have a fire lit up by then, they sure did now. Mind you, they still don't know his name.
Right.
They still have a name for this person, and they've only linked these cases through evidence. April 12th, 1998, this monster thought to himself, you know what? It's been a while since I killed someone. Been a hot minute. So he went to the house of a woman he believed would be home alone. Now, he knew this woman.
Oh.
He knew she lived alone. He had done like handyman work for her in the past.
Okay.
And he knew it'd be easier to like overpower her. She didn't have a partner or anything. So he cut her phone lines before trying to break in. But someone saw him and called the police. And he was arrested.
Amazing.
And just like that, they had him.
Yeah.
One of the most insatiably violent criminals. They had him in their grasp again. And that would have been that.
But
they let him go the next day.
The next day.
Why? Like, no, really.
Like, don't do that again. Why? Spank, spank. No. Go on.
Did nobody run his prints or his name or anything?
Doesn't sound like it.
At that point, his record may have only been like, you know, the assault, the possession charge. but he had done 8 years in prison altogether between those two convictions.
For violent crimes.
I mean, it was a first degree attempted murder. So it's not really just like assault. It's like he tried to murder someone.
Mm-hmm. So this what do you think he's going to do by cutting someone's like.
Right.
No.
It seems really careless to have released him the next day.
I'd say.
I don't know how that went down. It's terrible. Now, it would all come to an end eventually, though. It had to, one way or the other. One cold day in January 1999, Robert mailed his wife a calling card with a number to call. And when she called that number, she reached Robert, who was staying at a motel in Missouri.
Okay, wait, wait.
He
has a wife.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And he's just gallivanting around the United States.
He's married.
He's
he has
like,
a biological daughter. He's got two stepdaughters. This is what I mean by his timeline and his victim's timeline.
He's like, just call me if you need me.
Yeah.
I'll be out.
So he maintained this whole family life amongst the breaking and entering and raping and killing and shooting and attacking, etc. So his wife knew he was hiding because of that weapons charge. You remember when he went to prison for 5 years for the possession and weapons charge? She knew about that.
Okay.
So she's like, oh man, that's, you screwed up big time, but like weapons, who cares? Mm. So she knew he didn't want to go back to prison and he was hiding out. So she kind of helped him avoid being seen. And she thought that was the worst he'd done. So she was going to support him. She was going to stay with him. So she packed up the kids and drove to Missouri for a visit. So January 13th, 1999 began like any other normal day, you know, when you're hiding in a motel from the police with your family. I mean, it's just another ordinary day. So his wife arrived at the motel with his daughter and his two stepdaughters to see Robert. And the reunion was sweet. I mean, the children were so excited to see their dad. But they were told, don't call him daddy.
Oh.
Don't mention the name Robert. Call him Mitch.
Mitch.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the kids knew why he was hiding out too. They knew he had been in prison. They knew it was for the possession and weapons charges. And they didn't really think it was weird. So
well,
they were.
When you grow up in that kind of, if you're told it's okay as a child, okay, you're not going to think it's
exactly
wrong.
So the children were really excited to see their dad and stay in a hotel. I mean, what kid doesn't want to stay in a hotel?
Maybe there was a pool.
Right. So all these oddities were overlooked at the time. Robert put on a wig and glasses so that they could go out to dinner. They went to Walmart afterwards where he bought the girls some gifts and the family returned home to the motel where they settled in for the night to get some sleep. Suddenly, in the middle of the night, everyone was abruptly woken up to pounding on the door.
Who?
Now, Robert poops his pants. I mean, he probably did. I don't know that. That's not on the official record.
Literally?
But like, he probably did. So he was thinking, they finally got me.
Mm.
So he's hiding under the bed and has his wife answer the door.
What a coward.
Right. Scum. So anyway, when she opened the door and she's like, yes, can I help you? I mean, the kids were scared. Mm. There's police all over the outside of the hotel room, motel room. And so they see him hiding behind the bed. They see him and they order him to get out. And he just went nuts.
Oh.
He went nuts.
Oh my gosh.
He grabbed his gun. He started waving it around. He put it to his head. He said, I'm not going to prison again. His children are screaming at this point. His wife is like, put the gun down. And so the police ushered the family out of the motel room.
Right.
Because they wanted to get them to a safe place. And they wanted to talk him down because, well, the police were just there to ask him about the unregistered car he was driving. They were driving by this motel. They noticed a car in the parking lot that had no license plates. And when they went into the motel office to ask about it, they were directed to Robert's motel room.
Whoa.
So they
that
just
escalated a little.
They just wanted to ask him, like, is this your car? Like, why doesn't it have plates? Mm. But he was on edge. He was anxious every day, waiting to get caught. I mean, he had been at work committing crimes all over the country at that point, and he was getting super paranoid.
Well, yeah.
It was all going to catch up with him soon, and he knew it.
Yeah.
So his biological daughter, Deborah, told Investigation Discovery that she distinctly remembers the terror in her father's eyes that night. She described him as a dog being backed into a corner. She said she'd never seen her dad like that, scared. And he was literally backed into a corner with the gun to his head. And the cops, now with their guns drawn, are like, sir, we just want to talk to you. Put the gun down. We want to ask you some questions. And truly, they just wanted to ask him some questions. They had no idea the monster that was before them.
Oh, wow.
But Robert knew good and well what he had done. And he believed at the time that they knew what he had done. And he shot himself in the head.
Oh.
Now, he was taken to the hospital very soon after and pronounced brain dead. And I think that they took him off life support and he lasted for another 6 days. But he died January 19th, 99.
Wow.
Good riddance, you loony, I say. But in 2018, Parabon Nanolabs, Parabon, was sent a DNA profile that was generated by South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, SLED, if you followed the Murdoch trial. The DNA profile had also been linked to a murder in Missouri. So they wanted to nail this guy because clearly he had been all over the place. Tennessee, Missouri, Florida, all over. Because of the viciousness of his crimes, these couldn't be his only ones. Like I said earlier, they knew they should be looking at other cases.
For sure.
Now, Parabon did what they do best, which is they traced that DNA profile to Robert's family, which was confirmed when his daughter, Deborah, willingly gave a DNA sample. Because of that match, they had enough to exhume Robert's body in order to take his DNA for a direct comparison.
Okay.
And officially wrap things up in these cases. After the DNA was obtained, he was linked to the murders of Sherry and her daughter Megan and Genevieve Zitricki. Now, Robert was born in 1958. Who cares about the date? We don't know much about his childhood, which that may be okay with most people, but you know, I love a retrospective study. I just can't help it.
Yeah, like what? Where did this come from? Well, why?
To be able to look back at a serial killer's childhood is so informative of trajectory. I mean, we talk about the animal harming, that kind of stuff early on. But unfortunately, we don't really know a lot about his childhood.
But it's like all these young women that were, that he targeted.
Yeah.
And not to mention that note found on the mirror about don't F with my family. It's like, was there something in his psyche that, you know, he was trying to get back at somebody and that was a note to them, or was it just really,
it's really shocking because that was such a discrepancy in his MO.
Yeah.
I mean, I get the
true,
you know, like the water, running water all over the body so you don't leave DNA, torching the place so you don't leave DNA.
He definitely tried to
leaving cover up a note. That was really strange.
And yeah, that could have definitely been to throw him off. But in my mind, I'm like, is there something in his past where it's in his psyche that he's like,
Yeah.
It's getting like he's back driven at somebody.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. We do know, however, that he was good with tools, even weapons. He was very clever and manipulative. Mm. I mean, we know he was good with tools as a young kid, but he's breaking into everybody's houses. Like, who taught him that? Like, right. Did he teach himself that? It's interesting. He entered into the U.S. Navy as a young adult and lasted about 8 months, and he was discharged. Now, while serving in the military, he spent time in Florida and Tennessee, two places that he would later go back to commit crimes. But there's another victim we know of, and that's his family. His daughter, Deborah, courageously gave an interview on the show Evil Lives Here. Mm. She was very intuitive as a child. Like, watching her interview was gut-wrenching.
No.
She remembers so many details that seemed strange to her. And this goes back to her dad being manipulative, but she would reconcile those behaviors as a child out of unconditional love.
Right.
First of all.
Sure.
And then secondly, when he would leave, she thought there was something wrong with her.
Oh.
So she always, but she always had this discernment that she couldn't put aside almost. Now, Deborah knew he was in and out of jail, but she thought that they weren't serious offenses, and he always came back. She remembered helping her mom conceal her dad when he got out of jail one time. They bought a rug and they like hid her dad down on the floorboard. And when they got home, her mom and sisters and her, they all grabbed ends of the rug and walked the rug into the house. And he like walked behind the rug
what in the
to
world?
Get into the house. And it was around that time when he took off again. And shortly after that was when he killed himself. Now, Robert Brashears was just another loser criminal when he ended his life. His wife and children were devastated when he died. I mean, you should read the obituary. It's like, loving father.
Oh,
I mean,
no.
They just thought he was a freaking loser criminal. They had no idea.
That breaks my heart.
And they couldn't make sense of why he would end his life over some silly weapons charge. They just thought, man, he just really didn't want to go back to prison. Now, Robert Brashears' timeline may have ended there, but that investigative timeline continued on. We found out what only he knew all along. He was violent, deviant. He was a pedophile serial killer. And at no point did this guy have any remorse for his actions. He was raping and killing young girls while he had three young daughters the whole time.
How do you control, like you said earlier, he couldn't control himself, but how do you control yourself?
How do you separate the two? Like, Deborah said that there were times when he would get really angry. Like, every once in a while, he'd get really angry and he would take it out on the stepsisters.
Aww.
Like, he would, you know, be aggressive with them, but it never got anywhere near this type of violent behavior. Ultimately, he killed himself, but he wanted to maintain control over his own life. And
True.
He wasn't going back to prison. That's why he did it. He was like, I just need to have control. And as I said at the top of the episode, I'm willing to bet that he's responsible for many more crimes.
Oh, yeah.
And we might be finding out sooner than later, especially because of this massive breakthrough in the yogurt shop case.
Right.
It may be another year or so, maybe 5 years. And, you know, these things take time. But I bet there are departments across the country on the phone, emailing each other, sending profiles to compare, like revisiting cold cases, cracking open old dusty boxes. Like,
I hope it's caused a stir like that.
There's just no way that's all he's done.
No.
When he was all over the place.
Yeah.
He was committing attacks multiple times a day.
I mean, you have Florida, you have Texas, you have Tennessee. There are several states in between.
South Carolina.
Several states in between.
Yeah. So many victims. So many lives lost and destroyed because he was out there being a living, breathing demon on earth. Rest in peace to Jenny, Sherry, Megan, Eliza, Amy, Jennifer, Sarah, his unnamed rape victims, mm-hmm. and whoever else he killed that we don't know about. I will do a follow-up episode.
Yeah.
If we ever learn any other things. But this is one of the weirdest cases. Like, this is one of the weirdest serial killers, mm-hmm. because generally we are able to, you know, try them, convict them.
Right.
And learn. Look at the Green River Killer, for crying out loud.
Right.
He's old, wrinkly, and we're taking him down.
Right.
He's still alive, and we're going to punish him for what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh.
But that's, it's...
To be able to find out that the guy who did all this, he's already dead. And oh, my gosh, he did this too. The yogurt shop murders. One of the most infamous cases.
That's incredible. I'm just... That gives you a sense of pride for these people who were able to find the evidence, the bullet casing, and that's just...
So John Johnson was the original detective on the yogurt shop case.
Oh, okay.
And I have this cute picture of him. He's wearing this like green striped shirt that he wore back when he started the case. I guess they wore that at the yogurt shop.
Okay.
But he did it in honor of finally solving the case. And first of all, he hasn't aged in a day. I must know his skincare routine because he looks the exact same. But yeah, I mean, he just looks proud. I mean, he retired and moved on with his life, but he obviously, this is
the something... one he couldn't forget.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So amazing work.
Yeah.
Amazing work, detectives. Bravo. Keep up the good work.
Yes.
Let's get some other people, maybe not justice, but they'll be able to get some type of closure, whatever that means to them. But yeah, that's all I got.
Oh, well, I'm glad you got fired up about this.
Oh, I was fired up.
So that you could tell us about it and all these... sweet victims. There's just no, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
Why things like that have to happen or that why they do happen. There's just pure evil in this world. Mm-hmm. And that's but the bottom line. But yes, rest in peace. Fly high, angels.
I know.
Well, that was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, let's do it again.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. Get connected with us by becoming a free member on our Patreon. Or for just $5 a month, you'll have access to bonus episodes, discussion groups, and much more. If you can't afford $5 a month, we get it. Inflation, am I right? Please consider leaving us a positive review and rating wherever you listen.
And don't forget merch. Support our podcast and show the love by sporting t-shirts with our latest designs or grab an evidence bag to keep the chain of custody for all your valuables. Don't forget to follow our show on your favorite streaming app so you never miss an episode and get photos and updates on our Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or our Cousins on Crime Facebook page. Have a case suggestion? Email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.